Welcome to Gospel and Life. Today, Tim Keller is exploring the meaning of the cross. After you've listened, we'd appreciate it if you take a moment to rate and review the podcast. Your response helps others discover and experience the life-giving truth and grace of the gospel, because the gospel changes everything. Now, here's Dr. Keller with today's teaching.
You see, in Matthew and Mark and Luke, Jesus comes in to Jerusalem riding and being hailed as the king on Palm Sunday, which is 1 week before Easter. But in every one of those gospels, we see that virtually immediately, they all write it up a little bit differently, but virtually immediately he goes to the temple. Because you see, on Palm Sunday, he's not just coming into Jerusalem as king, he's coming to the temple as king. And what he does in the temple seems so odd and so strange. Here you have gentle Jesus, meek and mild, whipping people. Matthew and Mark and John, they all put it. If you read all of the gospel writers, every one of them talks about the cleansing of the temple. If you put all of the accounts together, we get quite a bit of details. He made a whip out of cords. He hit people. He threw over the money changers' tables. He threw over the animal sellers' tables. He yelled. Here he is, Jesus, I am meek and lowly of heart. Come to me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden. And here he is, terrible in his wrath, thunder in his voice, fire in his eyes. The only recorded act of violence done by Jesus. Why? I already actually told you why. We're going to spend the rest of the time unhooking it and unpacking it. He didn't come to Jerusalem declared as king. He came not just to Jerusalem declaring himself as king. He came to the temple declaring himself as king. This is such a violent act. This is such a radical act. The question that comes up right away is, what did it mean? And to answer that question, we have to first ask ourselves, what does the temple mean? And then, what does the cleansing of the temple mean? Hear that? First, what does the temple mean? What does the cleansing of the temple mean? And as we move on through, if you've got questions, keep notes in your head or write them on your bulletin, because afterwards, as usual, we'll have our question and answer time downstairs in the East Lounge. First, what's the temple mean? A lot of people think of the temple. The temple, of course, doesn't exist today. The temple in Jerusalem was destroyed many years ago. But when people have hear of the temple, and many people have heard of it, it's a very famous building of antiquity, there's a tendency to think of a temple the way we would think of a cathedral. Now, you see, a cathedral is just a bigger version of a church. Nothing happens in a cathedral, really, that doesn't happen in a little dinky church building in a storefront area. There's no fundamental or essential difference between what happens in a cathedral and what happens in a church, any other church. But, therefore, it's possible to project that onto the temple and think that the temple was just a great big synagogue, that it was just a place where people held services, just like people held services in synagogues. No. The reason, as we're going to see in a minute, the reason you had to have money changers and sellers there was because the Jews, no matter where they were, had to come back to the temple. No matter where they were in the world, they had to come back to the temple, because the temple was a unique place, and there were two things that happened there that happened nowhere else. The Jews understood that there were two things that happened in that temple that happened nowhere else in the world. What were those two things? First, the temple was the place where you actually could meet God face to face. It was the place for personal encounter. That's the reason why the psalmist, when they were exiled from the temple, the psalmist says, oh, I want to come and see you face to face. I want to come to your sanctuary. I want to behold your holiness and so on. What does that mean? Somebody says, I thought God is everywhere. Well, yeah, in a sense. But you miss the richness of biblical religion if you think of it that way. Think for a minute of Henry Ford. Henry Ford, when he was alive, was a tremendous presence all through America. He was he had a tremendous impact on American society in every way. And of course, by the time he was done with his life, near the end of his life, he was very famous. Everybody knew what he looked like. They'd seen his picture. Everybody knew what he had done and everything about him because they had read about it. And not only that, on every street in America, you could see his handiwork. you know, praising the glory of the ingenuity of their maker, the Model T's and so on. But everybody knew that if you wanted to have a personal relationship with Henry Ford, you had to go find out where his face lived, you know, where his body was, where his presence dwelt. And that was the only place, at his face, the relational gate into him that you could actually meet him. Now, same thing with God. The Bible tells us that all human beings have a sense of God, a strong sense of God, in their heart, in their conscience. Even those of us who want to eschew the idea of the existence of God find ourselves, you know, as the cynic once said, there are no atheists in foxholes, and we find ourselves in dire straits calling out anyway. There's a sense of God, and of course we can see his handiwork everywhere. Every place you look in the world, in nature, you see him and you sense his presence. But the claim was this, that it was at the temple that his royal presence dwelled, his face. What does that mean? Well, you know, we're speaking in anthropomorphic terms. That means we're using terms from our own physical universe and our own human relationships to try to get across this idea. Or I should say God used these terms when he explained this to us. He used terms that we could relate to from our own physical and human relationships and universe. But what he was saying is that there was a spot at which you could actually come in and know me personally, not just vaguely, not just generally. You could know me personally. My royal presence, the Shekinah glory, it was called, the overwhelming face and presence of God, dwelt in the middle of the temple in the Holy of Holies. It was fatal for people. It was that overwhelming to the weak human being. It was overwhelming. Only the high priest could go back once a year. That was what's so unique about the temple. His presence was there, his raw presence, his royal central sacramental presence, right there. And that was the first thing that made the temple unique. But there was a second thing that made the temple unique. And the second thing was that it was not just the place of meeting God face to face, but because it was the place of meeting God face to face, it was also, secondly, the place of sacrifice. It was the place, and that's why they have this issue here with the selling of animals, it was the place where sacrifices for sin were made. Sacrifices of blood were made to atone for sin. Now, here's why. The temple represents the teaching of biblical religion that you can't approach God any old way. You can't just approach him any old way. You just can't go in and say hi. It was the place of meeting, but if you wanted to meet him, there had to be a sacrifice. Well, somebody says, why? And there's a couple of ways of dealing with it. One of the ways is to understand that biblical religion is really neither Eastern nor Western religion. It was interesting that the Jews, you know, lived right there on the bridge, the physical bridge between Europe and Asia. And Eastern religion believed that God was absolute but not personal. God was an absolute force but not a person you could talk to or love. You could just have mystical oneness, you see, a consciousness transformation to relate to God, but God wasn't a person you could talk to. On the other hand, in the West, in the Greece and Rome and Europe, they understood that the gods were personal but not infinite. They were personal, but they weren't infinite. They weren't perfect. They had their foibles and their squabbles and so on. So, you know, in the East you have a personal, infinite but not personal. In the West you have personal but not infinite. But, you see, the God of the Bible revealed himself as infinitely more complex and rich than either of those conceptions. The God of the Bible is personal and infinite, loving and holy, transcendent and immanent. And therefore, on the one hand, because he's personal, you can meet him. You don't meet and talk to a force. You know, you just experience a force. So because he was personal, you had the temple. Because he was personal, it was possible to meet him. But because he was infinite and personal, because he was holy and absolute and personal, you couldn't just go in any old way. Why not? Because you have to deal with sin in order to get into the presence of God. That's what the temple was about. And if somebody says, why, that's a cranky, primitive view of God. How cranky? You mean you have a cranky God that you have to pay for sins before he'll talk with you? What kind of God is that? I believe in a God of love. Well, let me put it to you this way. I'm going to give you an image right out of the Old Testament. God refers to his relationship to us several times like this, but let me modernize it. Let's just say that you have adopted an orphan girl as a little child, and you've raised her up. Now, you know, it's a lot of work to raise a child. It's tremendous cost. You just put your whole life into it. And as she got to be, let's say, of college age, you give her, your life savings to go off to college with. Your everything you've ever earned will get her through college. So off she goes, but she disappears. She leaves. She never shows up at college. She draws all the money out of the bank, and she goes off. And you find over the next few months, by various sources, you discover that she has gone off into another city where she is living a high life and she's living irresponsibly and she's spending all the money on an unbelievable number of luxuries and frivolous things and squandering the money in that way. And what would happen if a year or so later, suddenly she shows up and she just walks on into your place and she sits down and she starts chatting? Hi, how are you? Haven't seen you. What's going on? As if none of it had ever happened. What would you say? You'd say, whoa, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You can't start talking as if nothing's wrong, as if nothing happened. What about what you've done? You've got to talk to me about that. You've got to deal with the breach. You've got to deal with the betrayal, with the injustice of it all. Now, what is she going to say? She might say, well, you're awfully cranky. I'm just trying to be friendly, right? And you would say, no, I'm not being cranky. I love you, and I've loved you, and I still love you. And as a result, we've got to do something about the breach. You can't just come on in here any old way. You can't just approach me casually. Something's got to be done if you want to come into my presence. Now, let's leave that, because who knows what that is. But you see, the Bible says we're in the same situation. Unless you're an accident, a meaningless accident, you have a creator. And if you have a creator, then every grain of your strength, every molecule of your abilities and your talents and your money and every gift that you've got and everything that you have and are, you owe to him. Do you honor him that way? Do you treat him as if he owns you? Do you treat him with the gratitude that you should with which you should give him? Treat him? Do you give him the honor that you should give him? No. What we do is we act as if all that we've gotten from him is ours to do anything we want with. And so we go off and to one degree or another, we all want to be our own masters. We take our own money and we take our own talents and we take our own time and we take our own sexuality and we take our own gifts and we take our own intellect, and we do what we want with it instead of honoring him with it, using it in deference to him. And as a result, every time you decide, I want to meet with God, that issue has to come up. Maybe she is pretty, maybe that lady in the illustration says, oh, you're being cranky, but that'd be pretty insensitive. I'd say the average human being would know after that kind of betrayal that you have to deal with the breach and the injustice if you're going to establish a relationship. God says it's the same with me. I love you, he says. I'm not cranky. What's going to be done about the breach? What's going to be done about the injustice? And the Jews were given, in the desert of Sinai, a place where they could meet God face to face and a sacrificial system. And the sacrificial system, they knew that if they were going to approach God, they had to approach God with some kind of payment. And the animal sacrifices in which there was blood payment, understanding that the wages of sin is death, that blood payment was made in order to come back and come into the presence of God. Now, that system was a good and bad thing. The book of Hebrews tells us, on the one hand, it was a good thing, because it showed people that you couldn't just approach God in any old way, that he was holy and sin had to be dealt with in some way. And they also saw that God was willing to provide a way to deal with sin. And so in faith in his mercy, in faith that somehow sin could be dealt with, they approached God and he received them through the temple and through the sacrificial system. But the book of Hebrews tells us it was always incomplete and it was never completely effective. Why? He says, because it was repeated. You always had to slay that animal and you always had to sprinkle that blood. And the book of Hebrews tells us in chapter 10, you could never completely get a clear conscience that way. Because, you see, every time you did it, it reminded you of what a terrible sinner you were. And besides that, the very idea of animal sacrifice was vague. What really was it? What did it accomplish, you see? And so though it helped, though it was a temporary provision, it was never complete. It never helped you make that complete connection. You see, it was always partial. First of all, the sacrifices were partial because you had to keep doing them and you never felt completely cleansed. But not only that, the meeting of God was partial because you could get in pretty close, but you couldn't go behind the veil. Behind the veil into the Holy of Holies where the raw presence of God dwelt. And so the temple it was a place of meeting God and a place of sacrifice for sin, but it was incomplete. And then one day Jesus shows up. And he comes in and he begins to act as if he owns the place. And he starts telling people, you know what? I want my house to be a place where you really pray. Not just a place of ritual, not just a place of formal religion, not just a place of going through all of the rigmarole, a place where you pray, a place where you meet God. And he stands up and says, things are about to change. What was he saying when he came to cleanse the temple? He was saying this, number one. So we already saw what the meaning of the temple is, but now let me show you what the meaning of the cleansing of the temple is. Number one, let's give you a couple of practical ones. First of all, Jesus is saying he's after spiritual reality. He says, my temple shall be a house of prayer for all the nations. He's upset because people aren't really praying. They're not really meeting God. They're not really honoring the whole purpose of the temple. Why is he saying that? Well, here's why. You know, when you first walked into the temple, it said, when he entered the temple, he saw the cellars. Now, what was the cellars? Because the Jews, as we mentioned, came from all over the world in order to make their sacrifice. They were coming from all over, so they weren't going to bring their own animal. If you're coming from a long distance, you can't bring an animal on the boat very easily, or if you could, the animal might die. And it was important for the animal to be healthy and without blemish and so on. And therefore, because the Jews were scattered and had to come back to the temple to meet God and make the sacrifice, there was a very large and lucrative business that grew up around the temple. People were there to sell animals for sacrifice, and because the Jews would come from all over, there also was needed a currency exchange. So you had the money changers exchanging the currency and the animal sellers. Is there anything wrong with that? No, because the Bible had provided, the Old Testament, God had provided for the sacrificial system. But it was inside. Jesus found them in the temple. In the place where they should have been praying. In the place where they should have been concentrating. Now, if you want to know what it must have been like inside the temple, just imagine. Have you ever been to Canal Street on a really busy day? You know, with the vendors everywhere and the stores packed and the people, you can't even move through. Everybody trying to look and see what's up there to be bought and haggling over prices and all that. Let's just move Canal Street in here and all those people in here and then try to have a worship service. And you'd see, you know, it would be so wild and it would be so crazy and it would be so clamorous that the only kind of worship you could do in situations like that is to buy the goat or buy the sheep or buy the animal and offer the sacrifice and go through the ritual and get out. And so as far as I can see, as most commentators understand, what Jesus is saying is first of all, he is saying, I want spiritual reality. I don't want formal worship where you just go through the ritual. I want you to really pray. I want you to know God, not just do the right thing, not just believe the right thing, not just go through the ritual. Worship takes concentration. Some worship is quiet, some worship is boisterous, but real worship always envelops the whole person. And Jesus says, I want spiritual reality. Do you have it? Let me put it another way. Do you pray or do you say your prayers? Do you go through the motions or do you really connect? My temple, he said, should be a house of prayer. What he's doing is he's getting us to look at ourselves. He's saying, do you really pray? Do you really know God? Is there a real connection? Put it this way. Now listen, this is very searching. It's very difficult for me to even think about this because it just makes me look at myself. I hope, you know, and misery wants company. That's why I'm preaching on this to you today. When you pray, do the burdens come off? When you pray, do thoughts about God get big? Do they get affecting? Do they get disturbing? Do they get exhilarating? Do they get comforting? How do you deal with worry? Do you deal with worry by jogging? By just sort of getting somebody on the phone and just talking about it and talking about it, which usually, I think, makes you feel understood and worse, you know? What do you do with worry? Do you try to forget about it? Do you try to anesthetize yourself? Or do you pray and do you make a true connection with God so that thoughts about His wisdom get so big and so bright that in the light of that, your worry fades? What do you do when you feel guilty? Do you rationalize? Do you blame other people? Do you try to confess to other folks and get them to say, there, you're only human? Or do you pray until the light that shines into your heart through prayer, and in a real encounter of God, in the light of His mercy, your guilt fades. In the light of His wisdom, the worry fades. In the light of His grace, the anger fades. Is there a real connection when you pray? Is there real spiritual reality in your life? Do you ever weep when you pray? Not weep because you feel so guilty or feel so upset, but weep because you sense Him. You sense Him dawning on you. What Jesus is saying to you is He's saying to you, and some of you, I'm talking to some of you who are the most active Christians around. Is your life like this temple? Unbelievably full of religious busyness, and there's no prayer? There's no connection? There's an awful lot of noise. There's an awful lot of clamor. There's an awful lot of activity. Jesus Christ shows up at the temple because He says, the temple is about spiritual reality. The temple is not about just believing the right thing and doing the right thing and being a nice person. Is the temple was built so you could know God, so you could encounter God. God. And therefore, Jesus is saying, don't look at the externals. He says, I hate a religion of externals. Don't look and see how moral you seem on the outside, how busy, how active you seem to be, and all the kinds of religious activities and all that sort of thing. How often you go to church. Look beneath that. Is there a real encounter with God? Do you know me personally? Do you know God personally? That's what He's talking about. In Revelation chapter 1, Jesus always appears with eyes of flaming fire because He looks all the way down. Some of us are like the Pharisees. We're like whitened sepulchres. We look great on the outside. On the inside, there's a deadness and there's an emptiness. In 1 Samuel 16, God tells Samuel, go off and I'm going to give you a new king to anoint. And so Samuel goes to Bethlehem, and the first person he sees is the great, the biggest, the tallest, the oldest of the sons of Jesse, Eliab. And Samuel says in his heart, surely this is the next king of Israel. And God sort of slaps Samuel on the hand and says, Samuel, you're just like all the other human beings. Human beings look on the outside. I have rejected this one. The new king of Israel is a little squirt who's not even here, you know. He says, you're just like everybody else. He says, I'm not like everybody else. You look at the outside. You look at the savvy. You look at that which can be seen. You look at the superficial. You look at the glitz. I look at the heart. The temple is about spiritual reality and Jesus' cleansing of the temple. is his way of saying, I demand spiritual reality in your life.
Marriage is one of the most profound human relationships, but it can also be one of the most difficult and painful. In The Meaning of Marriage, a couple's devotional, Tim and Kathy Keller draw from biblical wisdom and their own experiences to offer a year of daily devotions for couples. The book includes stories, daily scriptures, and prayer prompts that will help couples draw closer to God and to each other. The Meaning of Marriage, a couple's devotional, is our thanks for your gift to help Gospel and Life share the love of Christ with more people. So request your copy today at gospelandlife.com/give. That's gospelandlife.com/give. Now, here's Dr. Keller with the remainder of today's teaching.
Secondly, Jesus cleansing the temple also is a declaration of his complete authority. What he's really saying is, I'm God. Do you see how, occasionally you run into people who say, well, where is there any place where Jesus claims to be God, where he comes right out and says, I'm God? You say, oh, just about on every page. Look, he shows up at the temple and he says, my house shall be a house of prayer. My house. And he starts rearranging the furniture. What does that mean? The only person who can rearrange the furniture is the person who owns the house. He comes in and he acts like he owns the place. He does. You know, actually, even in the passage, a verse before this passage that I'm preaching on here starts. Remember, Francis read a passage earlier, chapter 19, and down in verse 44, he looks at Jerusalem and says, they will dash you to the ground, you and the children within the walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. You rejected me. He comes in and he starts acting like God. He starts acting like everything belongs to him, and he starts rearranging the furniture. Let me apply this for a minute to you. What is he saying? He is saying, if I'm in your life, I rearrange the furniture. This is one of the ways in which you know he's in your life. Let me put it to you this way. Here, a Christian is somebody who has had a personal Palm Sunday. Hey, here's Palm Sunday we've been reading about, on which everybody saw Jesus coming into Jerusalem and they said, ride on, Hosanna, come in, O blessed King. But do you know what a Christian is? It says in John chapter 1, verse 12, as many as believed on his name, as many as received him, as believed on his name, he gave authority to become children of God. That means that every one of us should have our own personal Palm Sunday, a day in which he rides in, a day in which we shout, Hosanna, which, by the way, means save me. Do you know that? Lord, save. A day in which Jesus rides into your heart, in which you say, Hosanna, you're the King, blessed are you, ride on and ride in, come in. Now, that's what happened on that day. How do you know if Jesus is in your heart? How do you know if he's come in? You know, want to know how to know? He arranges the furniture when he gets in. Here's Jesus riding in on Palm Sunday, and as soon as he gets in, when he starts acting like king, when he comes into a place where he is king, he has the right to rearrange the furniture, and he always will. In other words, let me put it to you this way. I have a number of people who I say, you know, I believe in God. I believe in God. But I also believe that it's up to me to decide what's right and wrong for me. Now, my question to you is, the real Jesus, the real God, whenever he shows up, he doesn't sit down and say, let's have a seminar here. What do you think would be a good use of your gifts? You know, I'd like to hear from you. What do you think? You think it would be a good idea to lie here or not? Well, what do you think? Do you think it would be okay to sleep with this person or not? I mean, what would really make sense to you? Does Jesus talk like that? No. When he shows up, he says, I'm the King, I created you. And he begins to rearrange the furniture, and he begins to deal with you about things. Now, right now, if you want to know, this is the good news. Some of you, your lives are a mess, and you're feeling very convicted about things. And it could be it's because the King's in. The King is rearranging the furniture. Recently, I think God's been rearranging my furniture and showing me that I don't have a radical spirit of prayer. Very convicting. But you see, at least I know it's the real God, because reality always acts like that. If you have a God that never challenges you, never convicts you, doesn't have a hard edge to his will, lets you do anything you want. Jesus is saying that's an imaginary God. How do you know he's in? How do you know he's Lord? He arranges the furniture. He moves things around. He pushes you. He speaks to you about things that shouldn't be there. Well, what kinds of things? Yeah, you want to see an example? Here's the perfect example. Was there anything wrong with the money changing and the selling? There was nothing wrong with the money changing and the selling. Heck, that was part of the sacrificial system we've been talking about. But it was inside. It was crowding God out. One of the ways you can tell that Jesus is in your life is he starts to find those things which are too far in. Good things, not wrong things in themselves. And he also talks about the things that are wrong. But he'll also talk about the things that are right, but they're too far in. And anything that's in too far, anything that's crowding God out, anything that's too far in. Do you know what I'm saying? Can I give you just a quick example? Have any of you been children of parents who built their whole lives around you? You were their meaning in life. You were the reason they kept on going. They even maybe even told you. You were the only reason that they stayed alive. The only reason maybe they stayed together. You were the only reason. You were the thing on which they built their lives emotionally. You were their meaning in life. In other words, you were in the center of their lives. You were in their holy of holies. You were in their, you were in the central part, the resources. What kind of life have you led? You take a look. What's the results of that? It was destructive, hasn't it been? You can never please them. They're always trying to control you. You're always fighting with them. You know why? Because anything that gets in there too far, that tries to take the role of God, that crowds God out of the heart of the temple, has to be, will always create destruction, because nothing but God can bear the burden of being God to you without destroying you. No, nothing but God can bear the burden of being God. And Jesus, if he's in your life, will show that he is God, show that he has authority by pushing those things back out where they belong. Okay, lastly, we've seen the meaning of the cleansing of the temple is, number one, he demands spiritual reality. Number two, Jesus also demands authority. But number three, and actually you'll see that number three is really encompasses number one and two, Jesus cleansing the temple is actually his way of declaring that he is the final temple. Why is he the final temple? See, when he shows up and begins to say how things can go on in there, what he's really saying is, I have come to make the great change. The temple was a good thing. The temple was a wonderful thing, but it was a provisional thing. I have come to replace it. Because in chapter 20, verse 2, the very last verse in the passage we read, after he has cleansed the temple, they come to him and they say, by what authority do you do these things? And what does Jesus answer in chapter 2 of John? In chapter 2 of the Gospel of John, what does Jesus answer? He says, tear this temple down. Go ahead, tear it down. And in 3 days, I will raise it up again. Then I'll show you what authority I have. And they didn't get it, but we get it. He's talking about himself, his body. And what he's saying is, remarkably, he says, I am the real temple, of which this temple is just a foreshadowing. Why? Because what does the temple do? To two things. It's the place where you can meet God face to face, and it's the place of sacrifice. And what Jesus is saying is, I am God in person, finally. Yes, you can get a sense of God by looking at the mountains and looking at the ocean, but here you can see me personally. I am God come in person. I am the way to meet God, and I'm also the place of sacrifice. And what Jesus was saying at this point was absolutely astonishing. When he throws the sellers out, he says, I'm going to make the animal sacrifice system obsolete because I'm the sacrifice. If you go all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, all the way back to Genesis 3, Adam and Eve lived in the presence of God. They could see God face to face. They walked with him in the cool of the garden. But when they decided to be their own masters, they were thrown out because now the royal, raw presence of God was dangerous to them, right? Was hostile to them, was fatal to them. And when they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, and the Garden of Eden was the place where God's royal presence dwelt, what was put at the door? What was put at the gate so that no one could get back into the presence of God? You remember what it was? The flaming sword. And what that meant was, that was just the Bible's way of saying, the only way back into the presence of God is to go under the sword. The only way back into the presence of God is through payment for sin. Blood, because the wages of sin is death. On the day that Jesus died, every one of the Gospels tells us that the veil in the temple, the moment Jesus died, the veil in the temple was ripped from top to bottom. What does that mean? Jesus advanced against the sword, and it struck him down. But as it struck him, the sword, which was the law of God, the justice of God, you see, as the sword struck him down, it broke itself. Because he fulfilled. He was the final sacrifice. He was the ultimate blood atonement. He paid the price. So that now the same royal, raw presence of God that used to be fatal, right? Moses wasn't allowed to see it on Mount Sinai. Now the veil is ripped. What does that mean? It means if you believe that Jesus died, if you received him, that same presence comes into your life too. It floods your life. When you unite with Jesus, who is the temple, you become part of the temple, the Bible says. You become living stones in the temple. When you unite with Jesus, who is the great high priest, remember the priest was the only one that could go back there and see the glory of God once a year. You become a priest. The altar, the bread, the sacrifice, the temple, they're all Jesus. If you have had your personal Palm Sunday, if Jesus Christ has ridden on in, if you have accepted that he's God himself and he's the ultimate sacrifice, if you receive him as the temple, how am I? You've heard this phrase, all hell can break loose. Well, you know, I don't know why nobody ever talks about this. When Jesus died and the veil was ripped from top to bottom, what it's saying is, when you believe in Jesus and receive him as who he said he is, as the final temple, all heaven can break loose in your life. All heaven can break loose. Nobody ever talks about that. But let me tell you something. Heaven is a lot more powerful a place than hell. Heaven has a whole lot more power than hell, because it is triumphing over it. Jesus says, the gates of hell will not prevail against those who believe in me. All heaven breaks loose. All the power of God breaks loose, because Jesus Christ is the temple, the one who mediates the presence of God, because he is the sacrifice. So it's one thing to believe in Jesus in a general way. He's a nice guy. He's a great person. Even he's the Son of God, and I'm going to imitate him. It's another thing to see him as the final temple, the one who came to replace the temple, the one who said, through me you can have spiritual reality, and through me your whole life can be rearranged and changed, because through me you can enter into the presence of God, because I am the sacrifice. There's a lot there, isn't there? That's what it means. Put it this way. God says to you, I'll give you everything I have if you give me everything you have. I will let heaven break out in your life as long as you will let me be your king. Now, you know what? A lot of you are afraid of that. I know that. I talk to people all the time. They say, well, I would love all this, but I don't want to give up control of my life. I don't want somebody coming in and rearranging the furniture. A lot of people would like to say, I will be happy to be a Christian if this and this and this, if I can hold on to this and this and this. Well, you're bargaining with God. You're turning the temple of God into a marketplace, a place of wheeling and dealing. No, no, no. He says, I'll give you everything if you give me everything. That's a deal. If somebody comes to you and says, I'll give you everything I have, $100 million, how much do you have? And you say, well, I have, you know, I can probably scrape a few hundred. Fine, the person says, yeah, I'll give you all I have if you give me all you have. What would you say? Golly, I don't know. But that's what God's saying to you. How dare you say, golly, I don't know? It's Palm Sunday. Let's receive him. Let's pray.
Thank you for listening to Gospel in Life. If you've been encouraged by this podcast, please take a moment to give us a rating and review. When you do, you'll help others discover this resource. Thanks again for listening. This month's sermons were recorded in 1994, 2005, and 2014. The sermons and talks you hear on the Gospel in Life podcast were preached from 1989 to 2017, while Dr. Keller was senior pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church.